Peace of God, everybody, to the fourth of, oops, it says Early Buddhism 3, it should say Early Buddhism 4, fourth of our workshops on Early Buddhism, and for this month's course we're going to be looking at practice of meditation in Early Buddhism. We've looked at first course, we looked at the overall history and the background to early Buddhism. Second one, we looked more closely at the text critical method, which is the primary way that we use to discern what's early Buddhism and what isn't. Last week we looked at Buddhist ethics, which is, of course, the foundation of all Buddhist practice, and then this week we're looking at meditation. So finally getting into the fun stuff. Okay. So we've had a long, difficult road of boring references and all these things, and now finally we're getting into some lights and visions and peace and bliss and flying through the air and all this kind of thing. And as usual, I will try to alleviate the boredom of my droning voice by giving you some pretty pictures to look at. And as usual, I've gone through an extensive research methodology to obtain these pictures, which consists of Googling early Buddhist meditation and seeing what comes up. So, mostly what comes up is the flyer for this course, actually. But anyway, I really like this particular image because this sort of encapsulates, I think, a lot of what the early Buddhist meditation is about. It's very simple, it's very straightforward. Someone's just sitting there meditating, nothing complicated, nothing fancy, and especially like the water in the background, yeah? So she's sitting in front of a pond. So in the Buddhist scriptures, there's so many references to water and to liquid imagery in the context of meditation. Like each one of the jhanas is said to be like a still pool with the water welling up from underneath and so on. And we find this kind of imagery mentioned again and again and again. And I think there's something very significant about this kind of imagery in the way the Buddha talked about meditation. So even though when we look at the Buddha's teachings on meditation from an analytical point of view, then we sort of look at it in terms of the psychological factors that are there and the conditionality and so on. But also we shouldn't forget that there's this very kind of aesthetic sensibility that the Buddha brings to it. He was very concerned to sort of paint this picture of these meditation states as something that's very beautiful, something that's very peaceful, something that's very desirable, that you want to practice, you want to find what that peace is. Okay, so let's start out by just considering briefly what is meditation. And as this course is a historically based course, okay, so we want to look at, we're trying to reflect on not just what is the Buddha taught, but also how it is that we know that, and what is the lens through which we see the Buddha's teachings. So of course when we talk about meditation, obviously, the Buddha didn't use the word meditation, and since we're talking about an interior experience, okay, well, not even an interior experience, we're talking about a whole spectrum of kinds of interior experiences and practices and so on, then we shouldn't expect to find that there's a sort of simple one-to-one correspondence between, you know, the word meditation, or what we talk about when we talk about meditation, and what the Buddha was talking about, okay? So let's look at the background. Meditation. Why do we use the word meditation to refer to practice? What we're talking about meditation. Anyway, here's some background showing what the word meditation meant historically. So from around the 1200, it meant contemplation, devout preoccupation, devotions or prayer. From the old French, meditation, thought, reflection, study, and directly from Latin, meditationum. Meditationum. Does anyone know Latin? Something like that. Meditationum. Thinking over or meditation. Noun of actor. To meditate. Think over. Reflect. Consider. And ultimately, and this is the interesting part, from the primitive Indo-European root. So when it says PIE there, that means primitive Indo-European, so that means that the hypothesized root, which is underlies both the European languages, Latin, Greek, Germanic languages, and also underlies Persian, Iranian, and Russian, and also most of the northern Indian languages, including Pali and Sanskrit. So the hypothesized primitive Indo-European root is med, to measure, limit, consider, advise, take appropriate measures. In Pali, that root is mud, as in mana, which is conceit or measuring something. So to be conceited about something is to measure yourself in, to compare to someone else, right? And the word pamana just means a measure. So it's interesting that like in Buddhist meditation, actually one of the very common words that we use for meditation in the Buddhist sphere is apamana. Okay, this is the four Brahma Viharas, I call the apamana, the measureless states, right? The four immeasurables. It's exactly the opposite of what meditation, the root of meditation means. The root of meditation is to measure, right? But the word that's used in Pali means measureless. So this is quite interesting, and this is one of an example of how we can't trust etymology, right? Etymology is interesting, but you can't derive the meaning of a word from the etymology of it. So we can see that the Latin verb has also senses to plan, devise, practice, rehearse, study. So you can see actually these meanings, the traditional meanings in the European language, is actually not really what we think of today as meditation. Okay? It's more like a kind of reflective process of thinking about something in a more systematic way, rather than awareness, which is what we think of today as meditation. So why the word meditation was adopted, I'm not quite sure, actually. I'm not sure of the history. I don't know if anybody else has any insights or suggestions there, but I'm not really sure why or how the word meditation came to mean what we know today as meditation. But anyway, just wanted to bring that up about the etymology. But in modern usage, this is an example from Wikipedia, this is good enough. Meditation is a practice in which an individual trains the mind or induces a mode of consciousness either to realize some benefit or as an end in itself. Okay, so I think that's probably good enough as a general definition of what meditation is usually understood of as today. So the first idea is that it's a practice. Practice of training the mind or inducing a mode of consciousness, okay, not necessarily separate things, but it's the idea that it's something deliberate. You sit down and you do a specific practice, and it's a mental practice. It's in order to change your consciousness. Okay, so if I wanted to nitpick, I could nitpick that definition, but on the whole, I think that's not too bad. So this is something what we mean when we're talking about meditation these days. So then the question, of course, becomes, well, what was the Buddha talking about? What was the language he used, and what was what was he trying to convey by his choice of words? So what we find in the early Buddhist text is that there's not one word for meditation, and nor is there one thing that's meditation. Actually, what we find is a range of different practices, some of which are actually quite similar to what we saw under the traditional meaning of meditation, right? So to reflect over a topic, for example, yeah? So we find this kind of practice also in the early Buddhist texts, right? So to sit down and to reflectively consider, you know, a topic of Dhamma or something of importance and so on. These are also things which the Buddha, you know, recommended and taught very, very often. And so that's more or less the traditional European understanding of what meditation is. But we also find a whole range of other contemplative practices which are more awareness-based, and a range of words which are used for that. So rather than trying to sort of distill down one meaning for what meditation is, I thought it would be more useful to have a look at a selection, by no means complete, but a selection of some of the different words that the Buddha used when talking about meditation. And so this will give us some idea of the range of meaning of what meditation is in the suttas. in early Buddhism. Okay, so the first one, citta bhavana. Citta is the mind. Bhavana we translate as development. Literal meaning of bhavana is from the root bhu, to be, and bhavana is a causative form, which means making be more. Okay, so it means making your mind more, right? Enlarging your mind, enhancing your mind, growing your mind. Yeah, so sometimes called cultivation or development. And the word citta bhavana, sometimes is citta bhavana, sometimes samadhi bhavana or other forms, but this is citta bhavana is a classic form. And I think citta bhavana on the whole, it's very similar in meaning to samadhi, but perhaps kind of broader and encompassing all the different practices that we use when talking about meditation. So that's perhaps the most general term for meditation in the early Buddhist texts. Then we have another very common term that we find, samadhi. Yeah, most of you are probably familiar with that. And samadhi is usually translated as concentration, and as time goes on, I become more and more dissatisfied with rendering samadhi as concentration. And I know that Ajahn Brahm is very, very strongly opposed to that translation these days. If we look at what samadhi means and the role that it plays in Buddhism, but also in Indian culture generally, the root meaning of samadhi is when things come together as one, when different parts come together as a whole. So, for example, in an ordinary language context, you can use it for building a fire. Okay, so when you build a fire, you take a bunch of different sticks and so on and so forth that are all separate, and then you bring them together to make one thing. Yeah, and that's actually quite an interesting usage. That usage we find in the Buddhist Vinaya, right? This is when it talks about building a fire. That's the verb that it uses, and it's actually quite interesting from the point of view of meditation, because the word jhana is also related to the word to burn or be illuminated. Yeah. So actually quite an interesting parallel there. So the basic idea of samadhi is that all these different elements are coming together and they're being as one. And when they come together as one, in that example of the fire, then obviously something quite different is happening, isn't it, right? It's not just a lump of rocks that you put together which is bigger than just a single rock, but when they all come together, something completely different happens, which couldn't happen to those things individually.
Yeah. It strikes me then that the reason to use the word concentration, because if you think of it like that, that's a concentration of a lot of bits and pieces to create the fire. So samadhi is more like, if you want to, because the concentration is used so commonly, samadhi is not so much equal to concentration, but rather the results of concentration. But of course, concentration now, instead of the noun, has been sometimes interpreted, even though it's always referred to as concentration.
Right.
We immediately interpret the verb, which means to concentrate, which is a whole
range of meaning.
Whole other different directions.
Yeah. In that sense, in concentration, like in chemistry and so on, basically just means like a concentrated form of something is basically just a pure form of something.
Oh, that's a different meaning, other than the collection of
material, you
have a concentration of.
Right. So you might say you have a concentration of. There's a concentration of doctors in the room. There's a lot of doctors in the room, so the doctors are concentrated in the room, something like that.
Oh, okay. So maybe I was actually using a different language, which might be wrong. I was thinking more of a concentration of efforts of bringing stuff together to create the fire. That's a constant. So that's how I was thinking. But there's also the other meaning.
I believe
it's really problematic.
It is, yeah. So it's not, I mean, it's one of those words where, you know, in a sense, it's probably adopted for good reasons, but it just tends to have that connotation, which is quite unfortunate. Yeah, that's a problem. So, but the other thing to bear in mind with samadhi is when samadhi is used in spiritual contexts in Indian culture, and both in Buddhism and also in the Hindu culture, it always has a very exalted meaning. right? It's Samma Samadhi, right? Samadhi is the last factor of the Eightfold Path. It's something that's very profound. And similarly, within Hinduism, we find the Ashtanga Yoga, and Samadhi is the last factor of the Ashtanga Yoga. So these are talking about very profound experiences of the mind, which is not really what concentration is. And concentration is a fairly shallow kind of thing. So oneness, okay, Samadhi is always a synonym in the early Buddhist texts for ekagata, which literally means unification or oneness. Stillness is another translation. Ajahn Brahm these days uses stillness for samadhi, which I think is also good, but the problem with stillness is I think it's also a little bit everyday. It also doesn't capture the profundity of it. I mean, yeah, okay, but it's not wrong, but anyway, another suggestion is coalescence. And so I think actually coalescence is probably the most accurate one. I don't know if you can actually use it in ordinary language all that much, but that, to me, that's really what it actually means. Samadhi is where everything coalesces. Everything in the mind just coalesces as one. So I'm gonna kind of try using coalescence, but I'm not necessarily proposing that it's the best translation. But I'm just gonna try it and see how it works. Anyway, yes.
What
does transcendence mean?
Because I was thinking in terms of oneness. If transcendence, this idea that it is, you are, I don't actually know what send means. So to travel across or to, to my mind, transcendence is some form of oneness that is a unification. Maybe that's right.
Transcendence is usually felt to be kind of a rising above. So in a sense, like to transcend the world is to rise above the world.
Trans is across.
Across or beyond, yeah. But again, we don't want to get trapped into etymology. But usually what you find in philosophical and sometimes spiritual circles is this contrast between the transcendent and the immanent. And so like a transcendent spirituality is one which you leave the world behind, whereas an immanent one is where you become one with the world. Yeah. So in that sense, transcendence is an interesting one in the context of jhana, and because you have both. And what's very characteristic of the early Buddhist texts is you find the use of both the transcendent imagery and also the immanent imagery. Right? So, for example, we looked at before the water imagery is very immanent. So you're soaking in the experience. You know, you're very much a part of those feelings and that experience is happening. But at the same time, yeah, there's this also, you find imagery of that's suggestive of being transcendent. And of course, the that's, I think, quite deliberate. You know, the reality is that these are just metaphors that we're using to try to capture an experience. The experience is neither one of those things. So if you insist too much on either side of those, then you sort of fall into an extreme. And so the Buddha always presented these things in a very balanced way. Yeah. Okay, so another word that we're mostly familiar with in early Buddhist meditation is jhana. And jhana basically in the early Buddhist texts is a synonym of samadhi, and the jhana is always presented as being the four jhanas. Probably the best general translation is absorption, but that doesn't really capture the meaning. The word jhana has a twofold etymology. The playful etymology, which is more of a pun really, in Pali the word jhana happens to sound like words meaning to illuminate or to burn, like the burning of a lamp is to jhayati. And so this is also felt as part of the meaning of jhana, although actually that's not the etymology of it. The etymology of jhana is the Vedic word dhi, which means dhi is a fascinating, very, very profound and important word in the Rig Veda, and in fact is the core of the emergence of a higher consciousness within the process of the evolution through the Rig Veda and the Brahmanical tradition. Dhi primarily in the Rig Veda means the inspired, the divinely inspired consciousness through which the poets or the singers of the Vedas channel Brahma, channel the God, into the words of the Veda. Okay? So it's like this feeling that there's like an uplifted or inspired state of mind, like a trance that you get into that, and then from that, the words of the poetry are spoken. Yeah? And so this is how, it's like we would think of channeling or something like that today, perhaps even speaking in tongues and so on, except with speaking in tongues it's just gobbledygook, whereas with the Rig Veda, it's actually very beautiful poetry that was coming forth. And so this idea from this Vedic period is that the dhi sometimes is associated with the rising sun in the Gayatri mantra, Om Bhur Bhuva Swa Tat Savitur Varenyan Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhyo Yonaha Prachodayat. It's homage to the threefold world. Tat Savitur Varenyan is that glorious rising sun. May with its divine radiance, may it impel my mind, my consciousness towards awakening. Something like that. It's very difficult to translate the Gayatri Mantra literally, but that's something what it means. That the sun is rising, and as the rising sun, we all wake up, don't we? Yeah? Our mind is becoming awakened, and may this illumination fill our mind and inspire us towards greater awakening and greater consciousness. It's a very beautiful verse. And we actually find echoes of that verse various places in the Buddhist literature as well. But in that context, the dhi is that inspired consciousness, that uplifted mind, which is moving towards a greater sense of awakening and consciousness. So this is that root of the meaning of the word dhi we find 1,000 years before the Buddha. And so by the time of the Buddha, he used it in this very specific sense to refer to the four jhanas, which we'll talk about more later on. Next, very well-known term in the Buddhist meditation, samatha. And of course, samatha in the early Buddhist text is almost invariably paired with vipassana. We almost never find samatha and vipassana separately. And when we do find them separately, it's only in very specialized circumstances. But in every major occurrence, samatha and vipassana always come together. They're a pair. And samatha, of course, meaning tranquility. And just as a sort of a note, this is quite confusing for people, but that samatha and samadhi have very similar meaning, and they also look very similar, but they're in fact quite different words. There's no etymological relationship between them. Samadhi is sam as a prefix, and adi is the root to put together, whereas samatha, the root is sama, meaning which is equivalent to the English word same. So samatha, the ta is just an abstract noun ending, so samatha literally means sameness or evenness. So we usually translate it as calm or tranquility or something like that. Vipassana, usually translated as insight, but personally I think discernment is probably a better translation. And of course, when these are presented in the early Buddhist texts as a complementary pair, then samatha is all about calming the mind down, about being peaceful, about being happy, and so on. So it's all about kind of emotional qualities that you're developing in the meditation. Is the samatha, whereas the vipassana is the wisdom qualities, the insight, the understanding, the discernment, and so on. And they always should be developed together at any one time. According to the suttas, you might develop one preferentially or put more emphasis on one or other at one any particular time, but ultimately they have to be developed in balance. I said that samatha and samadhi are very similar in meaning. If there's a difference between them, and I wouldn't want to insist on this difference too much, but if there's a difference between them, probably samatha is more general as referring to the practices and processes which are leading to peace of mind, whereas samadhi and jhana are more referring to specifically the states of refined consciousness which are the outcome of the process of samatha. Okay, so that's a slight difference in the way that they're used, although I wouldn't want to insist on that difference too much. Sorry, did we have a question there?
Where does
ekagata
sit in terms of samadhi and jhana?
Okay, so ekagata, I didn't put that up here, but ekagata essentially is a synonym for samadhi. So, samadhi is always defined as being cittasya ekagrata, is unification of the mind. Yeah. And jhana, again, is virtually always a synonym for samadhi. Yeah. So the right samadhi, sama samadhi of the Eightfold Path, is defined as the four jhanas. Okay? And every important case where we find samadhi used in the suttas is always defined as the four jhanas. Of course, you know, in contemporary meditation circles, we find that there's a strong distinction between samatha and vipassana, almost a division between the two. And you have, like, you know, vipassana meditations and stuff. And, you know, people always say to me, oh, you know, I did this vipassana in the Blue Mountains and so on and so forth. Is this as if vipassana is this separate thing that you go and do? No. This is not what the Buddha was teaching, right? Samatha and vipassana are qualities of the mind which you develop through your practice of meditation, and they're complementary qualities of mind. And you always need peace and you always need insight. Everybody needs these things. So as I said, in the suttas, you might emphasize one or other at any particular point. Maybe you do metta meditation, and the main point of metta meditation is to be peaceful and happy and develop those emotional qualities. Right? So you're emphasizing samatha at that time. But also that you can see that there's vipassana involved as well, because you see when you're doing metta meditation, for example, you're dissolving the difference between yourself and other, right? So the boundary between yourself and other becomes very thin, and that's moving towards an understanding of not-self, right? So it's not a complete understanding yet, but it's moving towards that way. And similarly, you know, if you do vipassana meditation, you see the impermanence of everything. And if you see the impermanence of everything, you let go of it. And when you let go of it, you become peaceful. Yeah? And so this is the samatha side of things. And so these things are actually always working together. And I remember when I was a young monk and I was getting all of these different teachings, and so I started out my meditation in a Mahasi Vipassana retreat. And so you imbibe all of these views that, oh, vipassana is the right way and samatha is rubbish and don't get attached to the pleasure and so on and so forth. It's terrible, terrible ideas which have infected modern Buddhism. The idea that pleasure is dangerous. Oh, these poor people who think that pleasure is dangerous are very sad. Pleasure is not dangerous. The Buddha said that there is a kind of pleasure which is going to be leading away from the Dhamma. Don't practice that one, but there's another kind of pleasure which is leading to deeper realization of the Dhamma. That one you should practice, you should develop, you should cultivate. Not bhayitabha, you should not be afraid of it. And that pleasure is the pleasure of samadhi and jhana, the pleasure of meditation. So when I met Ajahn Brahm for the first time, and you know, I asked him about this question, and he said, well, you know, when vipassana is right vipassana, if it leads to the mind becoming more peaceful, and you know that samatha is right samatha if it leads to the mind having more wisdom. Yeah? And that was a very, very beautiful teaching, a very powerful teaching. I've always remembered that. Okay, so samatha and vipassana. Another one we have here, anupassana. Very closely related to vipassana, basically it's the same meaning, kind of. But the prefix of anu has the meaning of continuity, right? So it's to continually sustained observation of something, sustained watching of something. And then finally, satipatthana, I've translated here as presence of mindfulness, or literally as establishment of mindfulness. Sati, of course, we all know mindfulness, and I think we discussed in an earlier workshop about how this choice of this word mindfulness was made in the 19th century by Thomas Rhys Davids. But the essential idea behind sati is the continuity of awareness, right? It's a recollection, it's a keeping in mind, right? So when we talk about mindfulness of breathing, what we're talking about is keeping the breath in mind. So this sustained, continual aspect of it. And so the satipatthana, sati is actually a compound of sati and upatthana, meaning to establish or to be present, have your mindfulness be present in a sustained and continuous way. Again, this is a difference between contemporary Buddhism, and it's very important to be aware of this. In contemporary Buddhism, you very often find satipatthana referred to as if it's like a separate or distinct practice. Satipatthana is equated with vipassana. The equation of satipatthana and vipassana is found nowhere in the early Buddhist texts. Okay, this is entirely a product of modern 20th century schools. In the early texts, satipatthana is primarily on the side of samatha. So the main reason for doing satipatthana is to lead to peace of mind, to lead to the practice of jhanas. Because, of course, you can't completely separate samatha and vipassana. That means that there must be certain aspects of satipatthana which are relevant in the development of vipassana as well. And so these are brought out in a few suttas. But the overwhelming majority of suttas, the purpose of satipatthana is to establish a presence of mindfulness, as in the most important case, which we look at soon in the case of anapanasati, of mindfulness of breathing. You establish mindfulness on the breath, and then that leads to this greater and deeper peace of mind. And so I actually think that of all the words in this early Buddhist vocabulary talking about meditation, of all of those, the one which comes closest in meaning to simply meditation is actually satipatthana. And satipatthana is primarily means basically what you do when you sit down and cross your legs and start trying to watch your breath or whatever you're doing in your meditation. That's basically what satipatthana is. Okay? And so whether that's leading to peace or to vipassana or whatever, that's all part of that. But the basic development of that meditation is essentially satipatthana. Although satipatthana is actually used in a more broad way than that, but this I think is the most core meaning of it. Yeah.
Satipatthana, can we apply to sila as well, or is it...
No. So it's a good question, but mindfulness, yes, you can apply in the context of sila, right? But satipatthana as such is a more specialized application of mindfulness, and it basically just means meditation. Yeah, so it's only in the context of meditation. When the Buddha talks about, like, you know, practicing mind, being mindful, whatever you do, and so on and so forth, this is not really talked about in the context of satipatthana as such. Okay, I mean, that takes some justification, right? Because you do find these things talked about in the Satipatthana Sutta and so on, and you'll find the justification for that in the 350-page book I wrote called History of Mindfulness. So if you want to go and have a look at all the arguments and comparative studies, then they're all there. We can talk about this in more detail later, but I don't want to fog everything up with too much detail. But just to suggest that the main purpose, the main meaning of satipatthana, it always says, a bhikkhu, gone to the forest, gone to the root of a tree, gone to an empty place, sits down cross-legged, sets the body erect, and establishes mindfulness. Yeah? Satin upattapetva, parimukhan satin upattapetva is the phrase. It literally means just does satipatthana. Right? It's just a verbal variation of that in the Pali. He sits down and does satipatthana. And so that's what the main meaning of satipatthana is in the suttas. Yeah.
I'm somewhat confused about the difference then between anupassana as in sustained observation and satipatthana as in sustained...
Same thing. Same thing here. Anupassana is the word that's used to describe what satipatthana is. Yeah. So when it says what is contemplation of the body, it says kaya kaya anupassi. Yeah. So the anupassana of the body is the satipatthana. It's the same thing.
So it still means anupassana and satipatthana are the two of all those that one can do, whereas none of the others are off.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
All the others are things we can't actually do.
They happen. Pretty much, yeah.
As a result of what we do.
Right, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, you certainly can't do tranquility, can you?
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah.
Jasa means that sila is the foundation for...
Uh-huh.
Foundation for samadhi.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, so the sila, but of course you have the mindfulness while you're doing the sila, but satipatthana is a more specialized term to talk about mindfulness specifically as applied in the more refined context of meditation. Okay, so moving on. So why do we meditate? And again, so what I've chosen here to meditate, why do we meditate again? I just Googled early Buddhist meditation and I came up with a bunch of images, alright? So this is giving us some idea of the different reasons why people choose to meditate. To relax. Right? That's good. You meditate, feel more peaceful. To be more loving. Yeah? To see the God within. Yeah, it's a bit more kind of religious, but this is also a very important reason why people meditate, not necessarily within Buddhist meditation, but certainly within Hindu meditation, Christian meditation, and so on. Then we have this kind of idea that you have a divinity which you're trying to see inside you. Of course, in Hinduism, this is very orthodox. If you do this within Christianity, it gets a bit problematic, right? It's why, like, people in Islam, the same thing. It's like the Sufis have always been a bit kind of controversial in Islam, because, you know, it's like you can actually see God inside you, and that's a bit disturbing. No, God is somebody up in the sky who tells you what to do, right? And to say that you see God inside you is very challenging. So, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, these kinds of experiences are, you know, they're very genuine experiences, obviously, right? There's an experience of tremendous power and light and radiance and consciousness and love and oneness and all of these things. But this is not, from a Buddhist point of view, we don't see this as being a manifestation of a divinity. We see it as being a manifestation of the power of the mind. Yeah, that's your mind. That's what it is. You can call it God if you like, but it's just your mind. To gain special powers, yeah? Right? Yes, very good. Has anyone ever read Lobsang Rampa? Yes, we have a few Lobsang Rampa fans. We should have a good start of fan club for him. He's awesome. Does anyone know about Lobsang Rampa? Yeah? Some people know his story. I actually discovered, I didn't know anything about him, but when I first went up to Santi, I just said, I don't know what ever happened to those books, but there's one or two Lobsang Rampa books in the library there, and I read them. They're fantastic. He was this completely eccentric guy who lived in England, I think it was like in the 50s, and he just sort of showed up at a publisher one day with this manuscript telling about all of his incredible stories. He's sort of wearing Tibetan monk's robes and these kinds of things, all these stories about how he was in Tibet and went through all the incredibly wild adventures and psychic power stuff and all of these kinds of things. And he's obviously completely mad. But wrote these fantastic books and telling about all these adventures, and as things went on, it just got more and more outrageous, and he was doing like these spy adventures in the Second World War and all of these things, and then he was supposed to have learned all of these different languages. And one classic moment came when he went to the publisher, and the publisher was like, was getting suspicious of him, you know, how come he's coming up with all of these kind of stories. And the publisher learnt a phrase in Tibetan, right? So to say good morning to him in Tibetan. So he was going to test whether he actually knew Tibetan. So he came up to the publisher's office and he said to him, good morning in Tibetan. And Lobsang Rampa just froze and then just collapsed in a faint on the floor, right? And then when he came to, he had this story for the guy. He said, his knowledge of Tibetan had been taken out of his mind because he was in this spy mind-altering program where they conditioned him to fall into unconsciousness every time he heard the Tibetan language. He's very, very fast on his feet. And then in his later books, he's like getting taken up by aliens and taken to civilizations at the center of the universe and so on. Completely outrageous. So anyway, this is another reason why people sometimes meditate. I think he lived to a kind of a... He's only sold a lot of books. Yeah. Okay, so another reason that people meditate, to actualize your spiritual energy. So people feel like they have this kind of potential and this kind of energy, and they want to, you know, move their energy up through their chakras, and you feel more alive, right? And this is something actually, this is a very real experience in your meditation, that you feel that you're, you feel sort of lassitude and dissipated and so on, and then when you meditate, you feel like you're revitalizing your energies, you're recharging yourself. And so this is another very important reason to meditate. Of course, we all want to be really, really peaceful, yeah? You remember him? Yeah, he's the Buddha boy? Yeah, you remember the Buddha boy? He was a sensation. It was about 2 or 3 years ago. He was sitting under this tree in Nepal for how long was it? 6 months or something? I think he was just sitting there for like 6 months or 9 months or something without moving. This kind of whole, because it's, you know, Indian culture, so this whole kind of circus sort of grew around him, right? And there's kind of, there's all these people there selling curries and all these tourists coming and everyone making money out of it and stuff like that. And he's just sitting there under this tree trying to meditate. But literally, he really did just sit there for, it was certainly many months. I can't remember, was it, I think 9 months or something like that? And there were several tests of it that was done, I think the Discovery Channel or something like that, they came and they sort of put the camera on him for, you know, like a week at a time and that kind of thing, and try to see whether he was moving or anything, and he never found out that there was anything wrong with him or any fraud. And then it was this kind of interesting documentary that I saw on it at the time, and they were like, you know, it was like these pictures of this guy, and he's just obviously just sitting under the tree day after day after day without moving, and they've got the cameras on it, and then they have the pictures of the doctors saying, oh yeah, it's not possible, somebody can't do this, that can't happen, this can't be real, and then obviously, well, it is real. Anyway, so he was there for a long time. One day he just disappeared and haven't been seen of since, as far as I know. Probably off. I think he just got sick of all the circus around him. He'll have to find somewhere further in the forest. So the other reason to meditate: to be free. Yeah, and this, of course, is the highest purpose of meditation in Buddhism: to find freedom, to find release, to find freedom from suffering, freedom from anxiety, freedom from all of the freedom from birth, aging, and death. Okay, so,
That last one, probably the one that I was waiting for, was the one reason I started to meditate, which was to basically therapy myself.
To therapy yourself,
and okay. I just realised, well, I guess that to be free is actually another way of putting it, to be free of the constraints and things of the past.
Yeah.
Emotional issues. So, yeah, that's a
problem. Yeah, I mean, I would think, I mean, it's just... I probably should have put that there, actually. Yeah, to therapize yourself. It is, yeah.
Well, in conjunction with psychotherapy, I discovered.
Yes.
So I think.
Yeah, that should be there. I mean, I kind of was thinking that sort of came under just, you know, wanting to be peaceful and happy and so on, but it's a bit more specific, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
But that's important, I think, to recognize that that's a specifically a modern development, and we don't find that in the early Buddhist texts at all. I mean, of course, in the early Buddhist texts, you find people have various things which we would describe as being, psychological illnesses or conditions or whatever of various kinds. Sometimes people have psychotic breakdowns. In psychotic episodes, there's no treatment or even a thought that there might be a treatment. It's basically just someone goes mad and then later on they get better. So that's really certainly no thought of using meditation in that context. In the more contexts of, say, anxiety and depression and so on, sometimes meditation is used, but often it's not meditation. Like the Buddha might sort of give a teaching. A classic example would be Patachara, who was sort of grief-struck by the loss of her children and her husband and so on, and so she's very traumatized by the grief, and so the Buddha counsels her and gives her a very beautiful story and so on to reflect on. So it's certainly not that these things were unknown, but the specific use of meditation to apply in a systematic way to address different kinds of what we would consider today to be clinical mental health issues is very much a modern development, and very much ongoing.
It's very separate actually from emotional wanting to be happy, because I know when I started I had even the idea of not being happy was beyond even my ability to contemplate.
Okay. Yeah.
From the heel.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I think that is a really valid.
Yep.
Being free comes closest.
So this is the classic image of freedom and liberation in the Indian literature is the swan or the goose that flies off, leaving home after home behind. Okay, so when all of these things that happen in meditation, they happen through a process, they happen through a conditionality, okay? It's not just random. This is something which is so important to understand, and this is something which we often mistake because we emphasize too much on the idea that meditation is something that we can do rather than being something that it's a process which we can cultivate. So when we understand that it's a process that we can cultivate, then our purpose is not to sort of make the meditation work by putting lots of effort into it, but our job should be to look, what are the causes that are leading to the deepening of meditation, and how can we cultivate and nurture those causes as best we can. And so to start with, we come to that general overall framework that we're working with through this course, Sila Samadhi Panya, Ethics, Meditation and Wisdom. Meditation in the middle, so it's leading from the behavior and it's leading towards the wisdom, and the three of those together lead to liberation. Now the idea that the meditation is based on ethics, right, is also, I think, quite a radical one, and also perhaps not one which is emphasized enough in contemporary meditation circles. I think there perhaps are good reasons for it, but certainly in therapeutic psychological context, this is not really emphasized very much. Sometimes it is, but it's very difficult for a therapist to tell somebody what you're doing is immoral, change your life, right? It gets a very dubious kind of ground there. I can do that. I'm a monk. I'm allowed to do that, right? This sound comes to me. I can say, no, don't do that. Don't break the precepts. But if you're a therapist, then that's, of course, very professionally very dubious to do that. So it's understandable why that's the case, but it's important to notice that the meditation really needs to be grounded on that good ethical conduct. First of all, because it's ethics leads to the states of mind that are conducive to meditation. Also, because if you don't have a good grounding in ethics, then you can still meditate and get to some degree some power and clarity of mind, but you're not necessarily going to use that in a wholesome way, right? So it is possible to use these states of mind in negative ways. The Buddha talks about rishis who developed psychic powers and laid to waste whole cities with a single mental act of hate. Right? So this is the original weapon of mass destruction. Okay. So I want to look a bit more at this process of meditation, how the practice unfolds, and how this conditionality works. The Buddha used this simile of the rain falling in the mountain tops, gathering into puddles, the puddles overflowing to form creeks, the creeks flowing into the streams flowing into the rivers, and the rivers flowing into the great oceans. And so this idea that there's this natural process, each little raindrop on the mountaintop is helping to build that flow of water. And those little drops are just the ordinary, everyday, normal things in your life. Every act of goodness that you do, every act of kindness that you do, every act of letting go, this is one of those little raindrops which is then leading to that mind becoming more pure, more still, more peaceful. So the practice of meditation in this particular teaching, this is found from the Anguttara 11, Anguttara 11.2, for a person endowed with virtue, with sila, there's no need for an act of will. May freedom from remorse arise in me. It is in the nature of things that freedom from remorse arises in a person endowed with virtue. Okay, so reflect on that for a moment. What does it mean? The virtue, the sila, the ethics we talked about last week. So if you're keeping your precepts, you're living in a way that's harmless, you're not hurting anybody, you have nothing to be remorseful about. We know what happens when you break your precepts. You do something nasty. You do something to hurt somebody. You feel terrible afterwards, right? And that terrible feeling that you have, if you go away and try to sit and meditate while that feeling is there, then you can't make your mind peaceful, right? You don't even, you think about when that happens, you don't even want to go and meditate, right? Because your mind is so ugly that you don't want to face it, yeah? Let alone finding any peace in mind. If you do find any peace in mind, then it's usually because you've just dissociated. You sort of shut out these bad things in one part of your mind and you don't want to face it. And you sort of come and I'm going to have this little bit of peace in here and keep everything else aside. And that's not real peace of mind. It's just like a fake peace. So, but if you have that sila, you've got nothing to be afraid of, nothing to be remorseful of. It's just natural. You've had that freedom from remorse. And it's this word that translated here is in the nature of things. The Pali word is dhammata. Dhammata esa. It means basically that's how the dhamma works, right? It's just that's just how things work. That's the normal way things happen. So it's not, we're not forcing things to be like this. We're not making them be one way or another. We're just taking part in, we're participating in that flow that nature has. There's no need to have an active will. May joy arise in you. Yeah? So there's this connection between the behavior, our ethical conduct, and our emotions. Right? Again, you know, we see this all the time when someone acts really badly. You know, if you have somebody who's having an argument with their partner or something like that, and then they do something they really regret afterwards, and they feel sad, they feel torn up inside. And when you don't have those things, there's just a lightness to everything. There's a joy. Yeah? And these things are conditioned. They're not just random. Okay, so there's conditioned phenomena. So when you have joy, there's no need to for an act of will. May rapture arise. Now these are different words, basically, different words for pleasure or happiness. The word which is translated first there as joy in the Pali is pamoja. And pamoja means just a simple, everyday feeling of gladness or well-being. Okay, help someone open the door, and when they're carrying the shopping bags, and they say, "Oh, thanks," and you feel happy because of that. It's pamoja. It's a very simple everyday feeling. Rapture, the next one, is a more subtle thing. It's more powerful, and it's more developed specifically in meditation and spiritual contexts, where you actually feel this sense of uplift. Yeah? And so rapture is a very energizing emotion. Again, it's not necessarily hugely refined or unusual. It's a bit more unusual than the pamoja. Each step that we take is getting a little bit more subtle, but it still is something which I think most people experience from time to time. For when you have rapture, then there's no need to have for an act of will. May my body be serene. May my body be tranquil. And it's natural that your body becomes tranquil. When your body's tranquil, there's no need for an act of will. May experience pleasure. And the word that translates as pleasure here is sukha. So for a person experiencing pleasure, there's no need for an act of will. May my mind coalesce as one. So here I've used this as experimentally rendering for samadhi. So when your mind is full of bliss, full of pleasure, doesn't want to go anywhere, it's completely content, everything falls into place. Not anything that you do, not anything that you make happen. And when your mind is coalesced as one, there's no need for an act of will. May I know and see things as they actually are. Okay? So again, see how fundamentally different this approach to meditation is to what we often find expressed in the 20th century Vipassana schools, where there's this opposition between pleasure and seeing things as they really are. Be afraid of pleasure because you get attached to it, and then you won't be able to let go of it, and then you won't be able to see the truth of things. Whereas where the Buddha taught that the pleasure, the rapture, the bliss, these are all preconditions for the stillness and clarity of the mind. And when the mind is perfectly still and clear, that's when you will know and see things as they actually are. Actually, that I should probably have adjusted that translation. It doesn't really mean as they actually are. It's a bit of a controversial point. It's somewhat hard to capture the Pali idiom in English. In the Indian philosophies, you tend to find a strong tendency to treat existence as being something which is absolute and eternal. Okay? So when you say something is, right, what you mean is I exist in an absolute sense. So this, for example, you say Ahamasmi, I am. Right? And that means that I have this eternal soul and essence, which always has been and always will be. This is a kind of eternal idea of existence. And in contrast to that, there's other forms of the verb to be, which imply like a conditioned and temporary form of existence as part of a conditioned process. And that's the word that we have here, right? So the word is yatha bhuta, literally as has come to be. Okay, or as has been conditioned, right? So you know and see things as they have been conditioned, or as they have come to be. So it's not, the idea is not that you're seeing an eternal truth. The idea is that you're seeing how these conditions have evolved through causes and so on. for a person who knows and sees in according with conditions, then there's no need for an act of will. May I feel disenchantment? You know, you let go of things, you feel dispassionate. Viraga sometimes means dispassionate, but also means fading away. And may I realize the knowledge and vision of release. So this is like the reflection back, and then seeing that letting go. So this is that process. We will be talking more about the wisdom side of things later on, but you can see here that this process leads, you know, we've seen the basic threefold ethics, meditation, wisdom, and then this one, this sutta is talking about how all of these things evolve through one process. They're not separate things. You know, the ethics leads to the deepening of bliss and peace of mind, leading to samadhi, and then the samadhi leading to insight and understanding, and finally culminating in letting go. This is one unified and very coherent process. And this is the normal way that the Buddha talked about meditation. Okay? It's very important to understand that the Buddha talked about meditation from so many different angles and so many different ways. But the most common way and the most characteristic way that he talked about meditation was as part of this context of an overall movement from our ethics towards tranquility, peace of mind, towards wisdom, and then letting go. And many countless variations of this teaching. Okay, so I've been emphasizing this a lot in my Dhamma talks recently about, you know, not forcing things, not trying to make things happen. And some of you are probably thinking he's just making this stuff up, right? So I'm just putting this sutta here just to show no, it's not making it up. Right, this is what the Buddha was talking about as well. And this summary of that same sutta. In this way, dhammas lead on to dhammas. Dhammas bring dhammas to their consummation for the sake of going from the near to the far shore. Okay, so this beautiful idea we find all the way through Buddhism. It's the little things that work together that keep on going throughout building to the big things. Each little dhamma, each little act of kindness, each little act of letting go, each little act of generosity, each act of refraining from killing an ant. All of those things, they lead on, they reinforce each other, they condition each other, and continually building on. And so when we see these very exalted, very high teachings that the Buddha talked about a lot, when he talked about jhanas and psychic powers and liberation and freedom from rebirth and all of these very exalted things which sometimes seem very distant, remember that this is just little dhammas building up to become bigger dhammas, yeah, leading from one shore to the other shore. Yeah? There's no, we shouldn't think of them as being something that's very distant. It's something that's very intimate. Yeah? All of those little dhammas, it's really just the same thing as those bigger dhammas. It's just a growth and a development of the same thing. This is also a good example of the question of transcendence, which was raised earlier. So this is, in this case, leading from the near shore to the far shore. It's a kind of classic kind of transcendent imagery, right? So it's leaving something behind to transcend, to go to another state. And as I said before, we find the Buddha using both kinds of imagery, the transcendent imagery as well as the immanent imagery. Neither one is sort of absolute. They're just different ways of picturing process. Okay, so for the next little while in this session, I want to briefly look at one of the most important, or probably the most important, frameworks for meditation which we find in the early Buddhist texts. Now, in this afternoon's talk, we'll look more in detail at the different methods, but for now I just wanted to give a very brief overview of the most important one, which of course is mindfulness of breathing. And the meditation which is taught most often in the suttas, the meditation which the Buddha himself said that he practiced when he went away on retreat. He'd go away on retreat for 3 months, and then he told the monks, if anybody asks you what is he doing, then they'll tell them that I'm watching my breath going in and breath going out. Okay, that's what he would do when he went away on retreat. Right? We'll just see in a few minutes, but this mindfulness of breathing is also equated with the four satipatthanas. Again, this is something we often find in 20th century meditation circles, that they'll say, oh, if you're doing breath meditation, then this is samatha, and then that's not vipassana, because vipassana is satipatthana, and that's something different. What the Buddha said was that anapanasati is satipatthana, and through practicing mindfulness of breathing, you can fulfill the entire practice of satipatthana. Okay, so mindfulness of breathing is taught not only more often and in a more central place than any other meditation, it's also taught in more detail. Most of the meditations we find in the early Buddhist texts are taught very briefly. So we don't find sort of one place where there's a systematic and sort of detailed approach to meditation. What we find is a number of different aspects of meditation taught in different ways in different places. And so for this today's workshop, we're going to be looking at some of those different aspects. We've already seen some of those important aspects, such as the sort of the emotional context that the meditation happens in. Now, with mindfulness of breathing, we do find more detailed instructions on how to breathe, and how to meditate. 16 steps or 16 stages, but actually we don't find that in the early Buddhist texts. It has the 16 things, but it doesn't call them steps or stages, so it doesn't suggest that you sort of necessarily literally go from one to the other. In fact, in some ways, it is a progression. In some ways, you can see that you are sort of going from one step to the next, but I think it would be too literal to insist on sort of a rigid progression in all cases. But in some cases, yes, there is a progression from one to the other. So let's have a look briefly at these 16 steps, divided into four tetrads. Each tetrad corresponds to one of the four satipatthanas, as we'll see later on. First one, breathing a long breath, then a short breath, then the whole breath, and then calming the breath. Okay, so this is definitely a very a progressive, and it corresponds very exactly to your experience when you sit down to do breath meditation. When you first sit down to meditate, you find your breath is longer, more coarse, your body, your mind is more agitated, it demands more oxygen, so that your breath tends to be deeper as you sit there. You find that your breath becomes more short and more subtle. Okay, that's the first two steps. So again, it's not something that you make happen, right? You don't sit there and say, right, it says first step is to breathe long, so oh, this is going well. I don't know how to do this. Okay. Now a short one. Okay. No. That's not what it's saying. It's saying it's an observation, right? It's understanding. You're looking at your breath. You think, when you first sit down, we know from basic physiology that your brain consumes a huge amount of oxygen, right? So you see your brain is churning away, stuff and demanding all this oxygen from your lungs. So when you sit down, your mind becomes a bit more peaceful, your brain doesn't need to do so much work, you don't need so much oxygen, and so your breath becomes more short, more subtle. What happens then, as it's becoming more subtle, is that things become less fragmented, right? Your mind is not jumping around so much. And everything, the experience becomes more whole. You'll be experiencing the whole breath, right? So this also is part of that step. And then as the experience becomes more whole, everything in your body and your mind becomes more calm. Yeah, kaya pasambhayam kaya sankharam. You're calming the physical activities, which of course is the energy of the breath and the energies throughout your body. So this is that first tetrad. And that's leading from the state when you begin to meditate all the way up to a state where you are sitting there very calmly. And I think most people who've done a reasonable amount of breath meditation will have experienced that kind of calm, and they will have experienced, when you can come to, really you hardly feel that your breath is there at all. Yeah? Sometimes it feels like it's completely vanished. Otherwise it's so soft, it's almost not there. Yeah? And so this is that process, that first tetrad. Second tetrad of Anapanasati. Sorry, yeah.
In that first one, how significant is the change in the verb from the first two to the second?
So how significant? Yeah, there's a well spotted. I skipped over that bit. There's a slight change in the phrasing from the first couple to the second one. But I personally don't think it's particularly significant. What does it go? Digangwa asasanto, digang asasaniti pajanati. So that's right. So you're breathing in a long breath, one understands. I'm breathing in a long breath, breathing out a long breath, one understands. I'm breathing out a long breath, breathing in a short breath, you understand. I'm breathing in a short breath, breathing out a short breath, you understand. I'm breathing out a short breath. And then when it comes to the next ones, it introduces this word sikkhati. Yeah? So it's sabbakaya patisangvedi asasisamiti sikkhati. So breathing in. The whole breathing in I will experiencing the whole breath or the whole body of the breath, I breathe in. That's how he trains himself. So it brings in this word training. And so sometimes this is interpreted as meaning kind of a more sort of active process, so you have to actually do this, right? The first one is more just observation, and then it becomes more of a kind of doing. I don't think that's really implied, but I think that's perhaps a more just a function of the English translation of sikkhati as training. I think it just means that, I think what the word sikkhati means is just that that's just what you're doing. You're cultivating that. You keep repeating it and going over it and over it. I don't think it's implying a process of sort of making it do that, but it's more about the repetition of it, actually, that you just keep on practicing and keep on practicing and keep on practicing and keep on experiencing that. Okay, so then calming breath. So then from the body contemplation, we move to the second one, which is complete emptiness. No, hang on, that's in the wrong order. That comes later. Okay. Second one, breathing, the second tetrad of contemplation of feeling. Yeah, so piyeti patisangvedi, experiencing joy, experiencing rapture. Sukha patisangvedi, experiencing sukha. Then citta sankhara patisangvedi, I've translated citta sankhara here as emotion. Actually, citta sankhara really just means the same thing as the joy and pleasure. And then is calming these emotions, so calming the joy and calming the pleasure. So again, is this process of moving from the joy, the rapture is a more strong, slightly more coarse kind of emotional response, and then through this tetrad we're calming that. Now again, this is something which many of you will have experienced in your meditation. It's not so common as the first one, so almost everybody when they're doing breath meditation will experience some calming and tranquilizing of their breath and their body and their mind as they do that. So that's like the first tetrad. The experience of joy a little bit rarer, right? Not everybody experiences joy when they do breath meditation, but still it's quite common and is something that you can cultivate, right? I won't go into too much detail onto that now, but Ajahn Brahm's teachings, of course, is probably the best. He's the one who sort of most emphasized on bringing that joy and bringing that happiness together with the breath. So if in your breath meditation, if you're not feeling that experience of joy, that's what I'd recommend listening to some of Ajahn Brahm's talks on breath meditation, and he's very skillful at bringing that out. So the breath is not just physical, right? This is something that's very important, right? Here we have a feeling breath, right? An emotional breath, right? So the breath is not some object which is separate from us, which we're having to pay attention to it. The breath is part of who we are. It's part of our own mind. It's something which we are doing and which we have an emotional investment in, right? If you don't think you have an emotional investment in your breath, that's fine. Stop breathing. I guarantee you, you'll be feeling some pretty strong emotions fairly quickly, right? That is what the breath is doing. And all the way through this teaching on anapanasati, one of the lovely things about the teaching is it has, it's a beautiful one to learn and memorize in Pali, because it is a beautiful rhythm, and the soothing rhythm of the chant is actually very reminiscent of the rhythm of the breath meditation itself. So like by chanting it, you're almost doing the meditation. Yeah? Dighang va asa santo, dighang asa sami, dipa janati. Digham va passa santo, digham passa sami, dipajanati. Rasam va assa santo, rasam assa sami, dipajanati. And so on. And so the chant goes, it has this very kind of soothing feeling. And when you're doing the meditation, also the breath has this very soothing rhythm, which is what gives rise to this emotional sense of uplift and pleasure through the meditation. Third tetrad, contemplation of mind. Right? So we have the body, we've had the feelings, the emotions, and then the mind. Here the mind is the awareness itself, citta patisangvedi, so one experiencing awareness, yeah? Gladdening the mind, avipamodayam cittam, concentrating the mind or samadhiing the mind, yeah? So the coalescence coming together of the mind and releasing the mind. So in this third stage, we're definitely in that area of deep samadhi. The mind, the word citta, In Pali, we've already seen the word citta used in a meditation context of citta bhavana. Now, in Pali, the word citta is a very general term which can mean the mind in almost any kind of way. It means thought, it means emotion, and so on. Almost, it can be used very, very broadly. But when it's used in a meditation context, okay, specifically in the context of the Eightfold Path, in the context of meditation, the word citta is very close in meaning to the word samadhi. Okay, and it almost means the same thing. We find many parallel phrases like citta bhavana and samadhi bhavana, or citta sampada and samadhi sampada, meaning the attainment of samadhi and attainment of the mind, and the development of samadhi, development of the mind, and these are all virtually synonyms. And so when it talks about the mind in this context, what it means really is that the purified awareness that we're developing through this practice of meditation, and particularly the purified awareness of samadhi and jhana. Of course, it doesn't just mean that. I'm not saying that it only means that, but that's the most important meaning. But generally speaking, it is the contemplation of awareness. So with the contemplation of the body, contemplation of the feelings, we are aware of objects of the mind, right? The physical objects or the mental objects of the mind. Here we are aware of the mind itself. We are aware of awareness. We are aware of the subject. So this is something which is becoming much more subtle. Okay. Last tetrad, fourth tetrad, dhammanupassana. Yeah.
Gladness.
Yeah.
Isn't that emotion as well?
It is. Yeah. It's very similar. As I said, you can't. That's why I said you can't sort of strictly divide these or make it too literal. Yeah. But yes, it is. It's very similar. A bit more modern and chitta. Yeah.
I'm still a bit stuck on that. The notion that's completely new to me, that breath is the feeling. These things occur, the awareness occur, but I never thought of them as being part of the breath meditation. I think I've got part of my training. I've got breath really kind of over there somewhere.
Okay, Do
you mind just clarifying
what
you said before about
expressing
the feeling?
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. So when we think about things, especially if we have from a Western or objective point of view, we tend to think in a very kind of dualistic way of seeing things, right? The mind and the body are kind of separate. Yeah, and so we think of the breath as being a physical phenomenon, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, but from Buddha's point of view, it's not dualistic at all, right? So from Buddha's point of view, we don't start... the problem with dualism is it starts by saying mind and the body are separate things, right? And then we'll work out how to analyze the world and so on. And then, oops, we have a problem, which is that how do you relate these two separate things, right? This is the great problem of dualism. Buddhist point of view starts from exactly the opposite. Right? From Buddhist point of view, we start from saying, well, what is experience? We don't start from an assumption about the world as we start from experience. Now, well, our experience has different qualities and different aspects, right? For example, we experience sights, we experience touches, we experience feelings, we experience thoughts, okay? These things are all part of our experience. Now, we can then, so that's the whole. So we begin with that whole, which is experience, comprised of all its different aspects, right? Now we can then tease out different aspects of that experience for one purpose or another. But this is not saying that these are sort of fundamentally separate. Actually, the reality is that they're all together. That's what our actual experience is. All these things are together. But for the purpose of understanding or analysis or various purposes, we can tease out different aspects of it and look at them separately. So, for example, we can tease out the different senses and we can analyze, well, sight is like this, sound is like this, and so on and so forth. But our reality isn't like that. Our reality is we experience all of these things together. So it's the same thing with the breath. When you experience the breath, you don't experience just a physical thing. You experience not just the breath, everything that you touch, right? Everything you experience through your senses is not purely a physical thing. There's also an emotional component to that, right? You like certain touches, you don't like certain other ones. Yeah? There's always an emotional response. And that's the primary reality. Okay? It's not that there's an objective physical reality and then there's a separate emotional response to it. The primary reality is the touch and the feeling and the emotion and the awareness and all of those things. And anything that we can analyze is subsequent. We tease that out later on. Yeah? So same thing with the breath. The reality is there's an experience, and we can see some of that experience as being a physical thing. It's a touch when we're breathing in and out. We can see some of it is a feeling. It's an emotional response, and so on and so forth. And so we develop them, but that's all secondary. The primary thing is just the experience itself. Does that make sense?
I have no problem with the notion of the mind and the body as being, of course, eventually, it all works together.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, I've had breath and everything else is somehow like breathless.
Okay.
I guess I'll just have to sit with that.
Okay. Well, maybe we can talk more about that in the discussion group after that. Yeah. Okay, so just. Moving on, so this is the. I know I'm aware that I'm rushing through this a little bit, but we will have time to discuss it and so on later on. So, the last fourth tetrad, contemplation of dhammas, anicca anupassi, contemplation of impermanence, viraga anupassi, nirodha anupassi, contemplation of fading and letting go, ending, and finally patinissagga anupassi, contemplation of letting go. So this, of course, is the vipassana side of things, right? The contemplation of anicca, impermanence is exactly what vipassana is. And this is emerging in that fourth tetrad, okay? So it's not that the whole thing is either samatha or vipassana. It has these different aspects. But the primary aspect, the main one that we're developing to begin with, is those samatha qualities of calming and gladdening and so on. And the vipassana emerges from that. And then just finally, before we finish for this morning's session, this is the equation between the breathing, mindfulness of breathing, and the four satipatthanas, okay? So the first tetrad we've just been through is equivalent to body contemplation. Second tetrad is equivalent to the contemplation of feelings. The third tetrad, the contemplation of the mind, and the fourth tetrad to the contemplation of dhammas. And notice that the contemplation of dhammas often is translated in English as contemplation of mind objects, and that's not correct. It doesn't mean contemplation of mind objects. What it means is contemplation, as you can see here, contemplation of the dhamma, the impermanence, the letting go, yeah? That truth of the dhamma, the Four Noble Truths, is really what that's talking about with the fourth tetrad. Yeah? It's understanding the nature of impermanence and conditionality, the Four Noble Truths and so on. This is the fourth tetrad, is the Dhamma contemplation. So you can see from here that anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, it's a very all-encompassing practice. Simply by doing that, we can fulfill all of the four satipatthanas. It doesn't mean we have to do that, right? There are many other ways we can fulfill the four satipatthanas, right? But that is one way, one excellent way, and of course the other practices which come from meditation, some of which we'll look at a bit later on, are supplements to that and can also help and be supportive in various different ways. Okay, so we're running a little bit over time, but yeah, hang on.
In some scriptures, the fourth tetrad, the Dhamma, sometimes it's, the word, the study of phenomenology.
Yes and no, but I understand what that thing of the phenomena is and phenomenology, but the reason why that's used is because the word Dhamma, of course, has many different meanings, and the meaning which it has, especially in the Abhidhamma period, is Dhamma as phenomena. Okay, so Dhamma, phenomena are all the things that appear in consciousness, right? So feelings and sights and sounds and tastes and so on. Each of this is a Dhamma, as well as all of the mental qualities, our intention, attention and so on. Each one is a Dhamma, and they are all phenomena which together make up our experience, okay? So, yeah, it's not completely different from what's being meant here, but actually, if you look at the nuance of it, the nuance of what's meant by Dhamma here, right, actually is a bit more similar to what we had earlier in the sutta, with this, it is in the nature of things. Okay, It's how that flow of things works, yeah? Ah, with this cause, that's the effect, yeah? This is how it's specifically described in the Satipatthana Sutta. So, for example, it says when that awakening factor of rapture is present in me, I understand this awakening factor of rapture is present in me. When it's absent in me, I understand it's absent. And I understand why it's absent. And I understand how it can be produced when it's not present. And I understand how it can be developed to fulfillment. Yeah? So it's this understanding of that cause and effect, the conditionality and the flow of things. It's not just seeing it's present or absent, but it's also understanding the nature of how that flow works in the development of more. Yeah, does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Where in this sequence, if at all, does contemplation of sights and sounds and tastes and touch as separate sensory modalities?
Yeah. That really doesn't come into that particular sequence. Normally that would come under in the Satipatthana, under the fourth Satipatthana. So it's not specifically mentioned here under Anapanasati, but of course being one of the many other meditation practices and so on, which are also found many times in the suttas, but just not in this particular place. But we'll talk more about that. That will come under more next week under the wisdom section. Yeah. Yeah, just
does it always have to happen in that order?
Always have to. If you don't do it in that order, the Dhamma police are going to get you.
They are watching. I mean, some people are just like really naughty. They just kind of go off and get enlightened without doing all the other stuff beforehand.
Again, think about the simile. You know, the simile the Buddha gave of the rain falling on the hilltops and then flowing down and so on. Well, does it have to happen in that order? Sometimes it might flow uphill, but you know, there has to be some pretty specialized conditions for that to happen. The way that it flows down the mountain is going to vary a lot, right? The particular courses that it takes, and, you know, some of them will dry up or whatever. So there's a lot of variation. But on the whole, that's the kind of the overall movement, is that all the water will move down. Okay. So let's have a break for a cup of tea. The monastics will have our lunch. So we're a little bit late. So let's join up again at, let's say, 10 past. Okay, 10 past 11.